Hello and welcome to the Reverend Hunter Podcast. I'm Tony Jones, the Reverend Hunter, joined as always by the dill to my scout, Brandon.
Dill to your scout. What is this in reference of?
This is a To Kill a Mockingbird reference. Did you have to read that in middle school?
Oh, I'm sure we had to read it, and I'm sure I did like I did with most books. I did not read it. There's no way. And if I did, it's obviously not memorable.
Maybe you read the cliff notes and squeaked by on the quiz or something.
I'm sure that's what I did. I was pretty good at like skimming through chapters and finding the important things.
Yeah. Well, all the more reason for people to get audiobooks then, I guess.
Which I agree.
Speaking of audiobooks, my audiobook should be out a week from now, thanks to you. I mean, I don't know. Have you ever heard anything back from the publishing house? I never did, but I just assume that the audiobook of The God of Wild Places will be available on April 2nd on Audible.
I'm going to assume it will be too, because I haven't heard anything back. I asked a couple times just to be cautious if everything was right down to the specs and everything else. So I think we're good.
I'm looking forward to it, man. I'm so glad you did that. And yeah, that's around the corner. For those of you who are listening, if you're in spitting distance of the Twin Cities, I would love to have you come to the book release party on April 2nd. At Wooden Hill Brewing Company in Edina, Minnesota, my hometown, 6 to 8 p.m. Lots of fun gear giveaways. And Brandon, are you going to be there?
I'm going to attempt to make an appearance for sure.
Okay, friends, if you want to meet the famous Brandon, the sidekick of all time, come on down to Wooden Hill Brewing Co. and you can meet the mysterious Brandon Morton. You'll sign autographs, right?
Oh, like, sure.
Okay, what if somebody downloaded the Audible book onto their phone? Will you take a Sharpie and sign their phone for them?
Oh, in a heartbeat. Of course. That'd be awesome. Now, I don't necessarily have to sign my name, right?
No, you could sign whatever you want. Sign my name, sign your dog's name, or whatever.
No, that's cool. Yeah. That's cool. I'm excited for you. The big book release right around the corner. It's been great to see some of the reviews popping up online and stuff like that. So it's awesome. Thanks.
Yeah, it's an exciting time. It's a bit of a nerve-wracking time because you never know how a book will be received. Early indications are positive. People seem to like it. But there's a lot of unknowns because people have asked, so I might as well say, I mean, people have asked, what can I do to help your book? The thing about it is books sell because of word of mouth. So I mean, you can buy ads and you can get on, you know, radio shows and podcasts, and I've done all that and I'm doing more of it. But the real reason, that's just to get people to know that the book exists. But once you know it exists, then what it takes is somebody saying, you got to read this book. I think you'd really like it. That's why people read books, you know? So it's not unlike going to a restaurant or a movie. You know, people say, oh, you got to see that movie. It's so good. Or are you guys watching this show? Everyone's watching this show. It's the same with books. The more word of mouth, the better. And these days, word of mouth extends to social media. A really important component is reviews on Amazon and Goodreads and Barnes & Noble and Bookshop and all the places, but particularly Amazon and Goodreads. Those reviews, you know, people really pay attention to book reviews just like they do restaurant reviews. So if you want to know how you can help, that's how you can help. Tell other people about it, write a review, you know, post on Facebook or wherever you're socially active. Let people know about the book. That would be great.
Well, hey, Tony, I've got one question for you. It's kind of random. If you could pick any author, alive or dead, to read your book and give you an honest review on it, who would it be?
Oh, my gosh. What a great question. I think the first one who comes to mind is, I'd say, Jon Krakauer.
Oh,
because
wow.
I love his writing. He writes about the outdoors, you know, obviously. He's written award-winning bestsellers about, you know, climbing Mount Everest, about Chris McCandless, the kid who died in the bus, you know, in Alaska, And that, you know, he's had them turned into movies. I just love his writing. It would be incredible to have him read the book and review it. That would be amazing. So thanks, man. Yeah, as Courtney would say, just put that out into the universe and then, you know, it'll come back.
I was just going to say, we got to find a way to will it to him.
Yeah, I love it. I appreciate that. Yeah, so it's on sale, people. I know some people are already getting it in the mail. But if you're coming to the book release party, I can sell you a copy and sign it right there for you. Plus, you get to meet Brandon, which, I mean, that's the real reason. That's the real reason to come.
Yeah. You'll be the sidekick.
The sidekick. We finally gotten some snow here in Minnesota. It won't last long, but we really, really needed that moisture to recharge the aquifers and the lakes and ponds and stuff like that. So it's kind of gnarly out, but I'm actually not going to complain about it. I'm not going to complain about the gray, rainy, slushy days because we need that rain so badly.
Yeah, it's not that bad unless you're shoveling it. Then it weighs like a ton, but it is much needed.
It's Widowmaker snow.
It is.
I mean, it's the kind of snow. And I have some friends in town from North Carolina, and they're crazy enough to come to Minnesota for spring break. So they got to go sledding yesterday, and I had my car just running, ready to take somebody to urgent care. We had some tears, but we didn't actually have any broken bones. So that's always a success when you go sledding with no broken bones.
Especially with people that are not used to the snow.
Oh, yeah, exactly. My guest this week, I'm so excited to have my longtime friend Jerusalem Greer on the podcast. She's the author of At Home in This Life and some other stuff, which you can all find on her website, jerusalemgreer.com. That's in the show notes, of course. She has recently moved with her husband to Proctor Camp and Conference Center in Southern Ohio. And she is the executive director of that camp. It's an Episcopal campground, but it's not like your normal church summer camp. It's really something. It's 1,000 acres. They have a farm on, they have two different farms. They have like a working farm with corn and soybeans, and they have also a market farm. They have chickens and they have all sorts of other animals. They have a little duck pond, and she and I are cooking up some fun ideas for the future of how our interests overlap. So I think you'll hear more from Jerusalem and me as time goes on. I'm appearing on her podcast. We're kind of doing a podcast back and forth, which is pretty cool. But she's an awesome friend. She's going to tell us about liturgical agrarian shenanigans, and she's going to explain zhuzhing. So you hang, make sure you stay, make sure you listen for when she, I never even heard of zhuzhing before, and she had to text me how to spell it correctly. But yes, we talk about zhuzhing. So friends, thanks for listening. Thanks for your support. Don't forget to grab a copy of The God of Wild Places. Join us at the book release party if you can on April 2nd at Wooden Hill Brewing Company in Edina. And until next time, thanks for listening, reviewing, rating, and sharing the Reverend Hunter podcast. Here's my conversation with Jerusalem Greer. Okay, my first question for you is, when you like hear some Bible quote that says, "Woe to you, Jerusalem," do you take that personally?
Oh, every time. Absolutely. No, I just remember Pray for the Peace of Jerusalem.
Oh, you remember those ones. I see.
Yeah.
Selective, so I'm ready. selective memory. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad you've come on. We're kind of doing a quid pro quo podcast thing here. Like I'm going on yours and you're coming on mine.
That's right. Isn't that how this all works?
It should.
Right.
I mean, I think
so. Yeah.
Can you start by telling us, and by us I mean me and the listeners, like situate yourself geographically? Where are you when you look out your window? What do you see?
Good question. I am on the Darby Plains, which is in Southern Ohio. That's the geographical location. We're outside of London, Ohio, which is about halfway in between Cincinnati and Columbus. We're technically on prairie land that has been turned into farmland many years ago. And I live on about 1,100 acres, which is owned by the Diocese of Southern Ohio. It was gifted to the Diocese of Southern Ohio, which is an Episcopal diocese, by the William Cooper Proctor family of Procter & Gamble, because that's the part of the country I live in.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay.
And so this was their farm that they had. I think it was one of several residences. But it was the family farm. I think maybe Proctor's brother-in-law really ran it, or grandson. I'm going to get all of that wrong, but I'm new here. I've only been here since October. But we have a camp here, a retreat center, and a farm. And there's two farms here. There's a small market farm that we run as part of the camp. And then there's the big farm, which is we rent out the majority of our land to kind of a big ag farmer, really. It's a local farming family. They've been here for generations. And so they farm about 1,100 of the 1,300 acres, or whatever I said acre-wise. But they farm the majority of it, soybean, corn. And so when I look out where my house is on the property is grass. There's a beautiful sycamore tree. I see a pond. And then I see the highway that divides us between the other farms, where there's lots of silos and then lots of 18-wheelers going past two distribution centers that have now cropped up everywhere.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. So it's interesting, right? Like it's an interesting landscape. But so it's flat. It's flat, flat, flat. We're actually at like the highest point of all the flat. And so the wind here is insane. But you can see for miles and miles around you.
That's interesting, because I would not think of Ohio as plains. I would have thought of that as more of forest land that had been cleared for ag. But you're saying it's plains that had been cleared for ag.
Yep. It's plains. It's prairie land. And so when we do rewilding projects, which we're doing a few here, that's what we're doing. We're doing prairie grasses, prairie bushes, that sort of thing. Not really forest. I mean, there is some forest here. We have 70 acres of forest on our property. But yeah, it's prairie. It's plains, which is it. Yeah, you're right. When I started looking into it, I had no idea either. So it is interesting.
Yeah. Now it's, I want to, you know, we'll get to the journey that brought you there. But speaking of Proctor itself, it's just, you don't often think, oh, church camp, working farm. That those right. two don't, those two things don't, you know, the church camps I've been to have all been like, I don't know, on a lake with a high ropes course and a zip line, and, you know, often in the middle of forests and that kind of thing. So tell me how these two, a working farm and basically a church camp and retreat property, coexist.
Yeah. So a lot of people, in fact, the camp that we kind of come from in Arkansas is on a plateau. And so it's on the mountain, right? And there's several other camps in the Episcopal world that are all in mountains, and lots of our camps. We've got some on the oceans and some others, but you're right. People do not think of camp as in the middle of a cornfield, and or having a farm. But there's two things at work here. One is there has been a little bit of a farm movement within Episcopal camps and conference centers. I don't really know how that started. That would be an interesting thing to go back and look at. I think Camp Stevens, which is in California of all places outside of San Diego, I think maybe they were the first ones that really started that, because they were trying to be sustainable as possible. And so I think it just grew out of like a garden idea. So if they could grow their own food to serve in their kitchen, and it just kind of caught on with other camps. So there are a few other ones that are doing similar things. But for us in particular, I think we have one bishop who says, Bishop Smith says, Proctor started as a farm and it wants to get back to being a farm. So I think there's a little bit of that. I mean, how do you come to camp? You literally drive by thousands and thousands and thousands of farm fields and cattle and, you know, all these different soybeans and corn and hay and different thick sheep to get here, and then get here and not have any of that, right? Like, it just would feel odd. So I think that's kind of how it started, by that idea of, it seems really strange to be in the middle of this and not in any way reflecting that in our life together. And so that's kind of how that got started here.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I want to hear how it works on a day in, day out basis, but why don't you tell us a bit about how you got there? You already mentioned that you came from another type of camp property in Arkansas. What was that like, and what caused you to move to Ohio?
Yeah, so really we can blame Phyllis Tickle for everything.
Aha!
Yes, Phyllis Tickle, our mutual, the Holy Spirit.
Our dear mutual friend, yes.
Yes. So my husband, Nathan, grew up in a rural community in Arkansas, a very agrarian adjacent life. And there's one of those sounds. One of Nathan's, my husband's grandparents owned a farm. And so he kind of grew up a part of that community, and just, that was how he spent like his summers and his holidays, right? It was all that kind of stuff, and just absolutely loved it, but never considered that it was the kind of life you could actually go have. We're Gen Xers, and nobody was telling us to go be farmers, right? Like, they were all going to be doctors, lawyers, right? That wasn't the thing yet. And so he just never considered it as a lifestyle. I, meanwhile, was raised by city folk, and again, never really, I was not an outdoor kid. I didn't understand hiking. I was like, where are you going? What is, you know, what's at the end of this? I wasn't athletic. And so I didn't really connect with nature in any kind of significant way until I worked at a camp in Arkansas called Brook Hill. And they stuck me in the nature hut for reasons I still don't understand. I know. And I really took to it. Like, I loved it. I loved the animals. I discovered that I loved farm animals. And I loved taking the kids out on hay rides and doing that sort of thing. And so that, I think, planted a seed. So now fast forward, Nathan and I have had our kids. We're living in Arkansas in the city. And just kind of feeling like there's something not clicking in our life, right? We're at that stage where you're kind of looking at your purpose and how you want to raise your family and how you want to raise your kids and what you want to instill in them. And I discovered Phyllis Tickle. I kind of discovered her backwards from a lot of people. I found her book, The Shaping of a Life, on a clearance cart at Barnes & Noble after yoga. And that's how I found her. And read that book and then wanted to get my hands on everything she had ever written. And Nathan, for Christmas, went and bought me the Farm and Lucy series that year, which is a lovely little 3-book series about the liturgical year, but kind of told through her experiences of living and raising a family on their farm in Lucy, Tennessee, which you have been to.
Yes.
Which is amazing. So the prologue to those books, she talks about when she and her husband Sam decided it was time to move the family out of Memphis proper and get back to the land and kind of the way that she and Sam had been raised. And I read that prologue and started weeping. Just weeping, like, for no idea, right? Like, came out of left field, not something I was expecting. And read those books and just was like, I think there's something to this. And at the same time, Nathan was kind of having a similar epiphany about how he had grown up. And we spent some time with some friends out on their farm, their property, and just really thought that there's something here. We need to go to the land, you know, and started working that direction. And in the process of that, one of the things, as we started talking to everybody about, we think this is what we're supposed to do. We don't know what it means. We don't know what it's supposed to look like. The idea of working for a camp came up. The camp in Arkansas also had a little bit of a farm at that time. They still, I think it's more of a garden now, but the Episcopal camp, we were in the midst of becoming Episcopalians at the same time that all of this was happening. And so we went to that camp and we visited with the co-directors at the time, a lovely couple, Rick and Helen Hargraves, and they weren't ready to retire yet. So it wasn't the right time for us to go to that camp, but that kind of planted the seed of there could be a camp life and a farm life. Like there could be this thing where we could have the community we longed for and also kind of being a part of the land. And so we ended up not doing that, not working for that camp. We ended up volunteering and working with that camp for a lot of things. Because okay. I ended up becoming a minister of Christian formation for a church really near there. And what we did instead is we bought 8 acres in central Arkansas.
Oh, okay.
And yeah. And so that was kind of our first attempt. And we kind of tried to have our own camp almost in a way. I mean, we didn't run official programming, but I ran what I called liturgical agrarian shenanigans.
yeah. Okay.
On the regular, right? So we were doing farm church. We were doing flight kind for Ascension Day. We were having like Advent events out there where we were burning things, you know, big campfires and liturgies around that and house blessings and, you know, just kind of combining kind of the liturgical calendar and being outdoors and rogation, tide and all of these things. And so we did that for, I don't know, seven or eight years while my career kind of changed midstream in that. And really our boys grew up there doing that. And then we got to the end mm-hmm. of that, you know, they started graduating and leaving, which I'm not sure how, you know, why that's a good idea, but.
Oh my gosh. Oh, now they're okay. I right? agree with you on most things, I think, but
yeah.
honey, best thing that could happen is those kids to leave. I was it's just so before we started Jerusalem, I was just on the phone with a friend and who just had his second kid and kids like 6 months old or whatever.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, the greatest thing that ever happens is when that last kid leaves for college. Oh my gosh. Courtney and I like rearrange the whole house just uh-huh. to suit our own needs. You know, uh-huh. we just like go to the bathroom with the door open. It's right. incredible.
It
I
is.
Couldn't be
it
happier. Is. But anyways, I'm sure you miss your kids. I'm actually no, fine. No, I mean, no. I miss my kids, but I don't yeah. want them to come back. That's for sure.
Right. No. Well, because it won't ever be like it is. But I mean, I am like a commune kind of person, right? I'd be happy for them to all sure. have houses on the property with me, which okay, is, you know, okay, eventually okay. how we get to camp, right? But because I like them so much. That's the thing is that like I like them as grownups. I like my grown-up children. They're very interesting. They're very lovely. They're very smart. Mm-hmm. And they're just fun. Like I just, so I'm like, why are now you're fun and you leave? Okay. So that's just my experience. Yeah. So we kind of looked around and we thought, okay, the kids are leaving. Nathan was working in IT at the time, but like had this farmer's heart and was trying to keep, mm-hmm. you know, our little hobby farm going and commuting. And we just kind of were looking at like, okay, this is, if we're going to make a change right here while our kids are leaving is the time to do it before this becomes the place where like the grandkids want to come and right. Like where we, if we're going to get out, we got to do it now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we had the opportunity in the summer of 2022 to move to New Jersey of all places. And what we thought we were doing was going into a partnership with another couple to, kind of go and steward 140 acres in rural New Jersey and start a retreat house ministry, and a kind of agrarian spiritual, you know, retreat house kind of situation. And we got there, we ended up only living there about a year. The other couple, kind of changed their minds, to put it politely, about what they wanted out of the whole endeavor. And they were the actual owners of the property itself. And so, okay. So we kind of were going, we have to move. What's going to happen?
Right.
But we still had this like desire. I mean, Nathan had like quit his job and he had been the farm steward of this place in New Jersey. And we just thought, well, you know, and I had this growing desire to do more agrarian ministry, to do more belonging ministry or ministry of place. And we really do love living in community. That's like not completely like multiple couples in one house, but within close proximity. Right. And so, mm-hmm. So we kind of looked around and it was literally, I mean, I know where we all are on our deconstruction journeys, right? We don't like it, saying things like it was a God moment is weird, but yeah, I told a friend and I kind of made a joke. I knew about where we are. I knew about Proctor. I did not know that the position of executive directors was open. And I just kind of made a joke because it's where she lives that, oh, hey, well, maybe we'll end up at Proctor. And she, who's a very faithful praying woman, said, I have been praying about this. And I didn't think it was possible because you moved to New Jersey. And, you know, I just kind of was like, well, it's possible. Just kind of jokingly, haha. And she's probably got off the phone with me and made some phone calls. And the next thing we knew, we were interviewing to be here and move here and do this work. So that's the very long winding road of how we ended up here. But yeah, that's how we ended up in Ohio, which ended up being literally halfway between our kids. One's in Arkansas and two are in the Northeast. And so we are here now in the middle of a cornfield and it's amazing. It's truly amazing. And we kind of pinch ourselves that we get to be here. So
when exactly did you land there?
October.
In Ohio?
Like October 4th, I think.
Okay. So you've so it's really recent and you've only experienced kind of half of the autumn and one winter, which if it was anything like in Minnesota, it was not much of a winter.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So what's on tap? I mean, what's the summer look like for you? How have you been spending your days in this new position?
Yeah. So a lot of what we're doing now is just to get ready for what's about to explode, right? So everything right now is about either summer camp, because we do have summer camps for kids and adults actually, and families, but we actually have like adult camp. So you can come have the summer camp of your youth, but with your besties. As adults and bring your adult beverages if you would like.
Wow. Well, you are Episcopalian, so.
We are Episcopalian, yeah. So, you know, we're not going to provide them, but you can bring them. So it's all about that. But then the other thing is that our farm, our market farm, is about to ramp up. And so we raise hogs, meat chickens, layer chickens, and then produce. We grow produce and we have a market garden. We also have a teaching garden. And we're also about to add sheep to this whole project and we've got bees. So,
wow.
Yeah. So all of that is like in that beginning phase of, for instance, we have our farm manager just moved 70 baby chicks from his kitchen to one of the our winter coops are part of what's called a corn crib, right? Which is a place for storing and drying corn. And so the old corn crib has become kind of the farm manager's barn, and part of it is the winter chicken coops. And so he moved the 70 chicks. Once they started getting feathers, he was like, okay, I can move them out of. Because our wind here and the cold is just, it's like 35 today, right? So this is bizarre. It's spring, it's not spring, it's winter. So trying to figure out.
We're recording this on Thursday. And by the time this airs on Monday in Minnesota, I haven't started my snowblower yet this year.
Right.
Not once.
Okay.
Which is unheard of, you know?
Yeah. It's Minnesota.
We're going to get like between 1 and 2 feet of snow and, right. and, you know, I mean, you know, Trip Fuller, right? Homebrewed Christianity.
Yeah, yeah.
Good, dear friend of mine. Well, that's silly, dude. He's bringing his family to Minnesota for spring break. They're flying here on Saturday. No. So I'm currently rounding up sleds from my, because I, you know, my kids are gone. I don't have sleds anymore, but I'm getting some sleds from neighbors and I'm going to take those kids sledding. So that's going to be their spring break is 2 feet of snow. But anyways, yes, yeah, I know it's a little, it's been weird because it's so mild all winter and now suddenly it's cold, windy and about to snow.
Exactly. So similar things happening here. So yeah, so we've just got the 70 chicks. We're about to plant a bunch of trees. Like every day I go down to the lodge where my office is and there's like a box of onions or a box of potatoes or, right, that they're about to start planting. The greenhouse is full of seeds that they've started getting ready. They're about to build a trellis and a new chicken coop in the teaching garden. And yeah, so it's a lot of that. We've been hiring farmhands because we have a farmhand intern program for like young adults. And so we've been doing interviews and hiring people. And what's fascinating is we are going to have to turn away farmhand applicants because we have so many. And we are having the hardest time getting counselors for summer camp.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. And so we're actually having to ask now, like, there's no more farmhand jobs, but you will get to work on the farm and in the forest as part of being a counselor. Would you consider being a counselor? So, yeah. And we're even talking kids that were raised at this camp who would rather be the farmhand than the counselor, right? So,
well, I mean, as someone who spent many, many years as a church camp counselor, I think I'd probably rather be have my hands in the dirt than dealing with the kids. But this is interesting, Jerusalem, because I just read something today. Somebody, you know, I follow a lot of Substackers who are kind of like writing about teens. And, you know, you and I have both been interested in youth ministry and adolescence and stuff like that for a long time. And, you know, Jonathan Haidt got a new book coming out and there's more and more research about how bad cell phones are. And also, this was fascinating, the demise of high school babysitters. People don't trust high school kids to babysit anymore because we're all so worried about, you know, and thesis of this post was like, go hire a 13-year-old girl to watch your kids. They're going to be fine. Like, this is an important part of, I mean, I babysat a ton, but I wonder if the lack of interest in counselors is, you know, high school kids don't really care for younger kids in the way that we all used to when we babysat and counseled at church camp and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, all year long, I was my first position in ninth grade, we were called JCs, junior commandos. Mm-hmm. Because we were like the junior counselors, you know, and then you know, you remember all that. But that's interesting to hear you say that, that's really been a change.
It really is. I mean, we also don't have, I mean, it just makes sense as youth groups, get smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
I mean, that's your feeder ministry, right?
Absolutely.
Is the youth group. And that's no longer really a thing. And so even knowing how to recruit, thankfully I have staff that's part of my team is experienced in that for a few years. And so we've gained some wisdom, but rebuilding those relationships outside of just assuming that all the youth ministers in church are going to, you know, send you their kids and that for camp. And then those kids are going to grow up and want to come back as counselors. I mean, that cycle has been broken through COVID. They're just the church, you know, constricting in size and what that means. And so, yeah, it's interesting, but man, you say, come work at the farm and it even pays less. Like, this is the other thing that's interesting, right? Like, it pays more to be a counselor than it does to work on the farm. But no, that's what they want to do. They want to work on the farm. So,
well, I think, I mean, frankly, I'm sorry that you're having a hard time getting counselors, but the fact that kids, particularly kids from more urban settings or suburban settings want mm-hmm. to spend the summer working on a farm, I think that's great news.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, honestly, I do too. And it does impact how we're thinking about the future and what we're going to do and what summers are going to look like and what camp is going to look like and how it's all going to be, because it tells us something, right? I mean, it doesn't just tell us something about today. Yeah. It tells us something about 5, 10, 20 years from now. And we need to listen, not keep trying to force things to be like they were.
Right. Yeah. But the church is so good at that, listening to the younger generations and what they want. So shouldn't be a problem.
It'll be easy peasy. No problem.
Yeah. We'll get, they'll be that, all the people who run the churches, they'll be just fine with listening to the kids. I want to pivot a little bit and then spend the rest of our time talking about your work. And just how you're thinking about your work now. So much of your work has been around place and home and these kind of concepts in such a peripatetic, technologically advanced society, you know, even thinking of the fact that, your kids are spread across the country. And I'm in the same boat. Our kids are about the same age and my kids are in Austin, Texas, New York City, and Fort Worth, Texas. And will any of them land back in Minnesota? I would love it if they did. But I probably won't go 3 for 3 in that regard. So when you're a lot of your writing about that stuff was, when your kids were younger and stuff like that. So now that they've, launched, what are your current thoughts? Take this wherever you want, theological or personal or whatever, on place and home and that those kind of issues you've been thinking about for so long.
Yeah, no, that's great. Because it's so true. I mean, I was like an early mommy blogger, right? And I did the blogging thing and it was all about domesticity and connecting faith to that. And then I think that's probably why I am a little bit like my kids left. And then where does that go? I mean, where does all that go? And for me, it's going to camp and it's going to church and here it is. But I can remember being at Wild Goose and I had this, I only went to Wild Goose once and I think it was right after my first book. So it's probably around 2013, 2012, somewhere in that area. Mm-hmm, remember. It was when the Indigo Girls played and Glennon Doyle like jumped on them. It was whatever year that was. That's like my memory, right? And it rained. Of course it rained. But I can remember there not being anything about family in the home. There were no workshops about family or home. And it was almost like home was a 4-letter word it was all justice based. It's not, none of that's bad, but I just thought, but there were also all these kids running around. Like it was this very, very disconnected thing, right? And so the one year I think I did, what was it? Christianity 21, was that what it was called? Denver?
Yep.
Yeah. And that was like my little TED talk that I gave, right? Was about that, because I was so mad that we're not talking about how to do faith with our kids and we're going to lose them. And of course we lost them. right. Like, well, there you go. That's what happened.
Yeah.
Because we were kind of all doing we were all staring at our own spiritual belly buttons. And our kids were just running amok but we didn't know how to talk to them about it. We're all just deconstructing and how do you can't tell the stories to your kids that were told to you about God. So let's just not tell them anything. But that's a different rant for a different day. So how does that, I did talk a lot about it and I've done a lot of thinking and reading and kind of questioning this for myself. And I think that's really where I kind of landed on this idea of the theology of place or the ministry of place. And that place really matters for us. And I came to a lot of this through Benedict and being a Benedictine mm-hmm. At heart. And this idea that we get called to both people and place, and that the land, the place under our feet, the roof over our head, the trees, the birds, whatever, all the things, they matter and they should root us, and we should feel responsible to them as well as for them or it or whatever. And the other part of that is this idea of belonging, kind of the same thing that was happening as I was kind of wrestling with all that, is also this idea of loneliness and the epidemic of loneliness. And that belonging, offering belonging, not membership, but like true soul belonging. I mean, it's the Cheers moment, you know, it's the place where everybody knows your name and you feel like you can be your true self no matter what that looks like. And that we do some of that through place. It's not just the people. It really is also the place. And I think that's why camp ministry is interesting to me, and farm ministry, is that people want to come back to the place as much as the people, right? Like, there's something about that spot on the lake or that place in the barn or that tree, you know, that matters.
I totally agree. I mean, absolutely. And I, you know, in my book, I've got a whole chapter called Place, and it's all about this family land that we have in central Minnesota. But I mean, here's where I struggle, and maybe, you know, we can work through this together a little bit, but I have this very vivid memory of going on a mission trip when I was probably the summer before ninth grade, eighth or ninth grade, to New York City. And we drove the church van from Minnesota to New York, and I don't know, got there in the middle of the night. And then we were driving around. I remember driving around in New York City, and Paul, our junior high pastor, said, hey, I want you guys to tell me, you know, like, shout whenever you see a golf course, shout whenever you see tennis courts and a park. And so we're like, oh yeah. So we start, of course, there's none of that.
Right.
There's just apartment building after apartment building. And his point was obviously like, we in Edina, Minnesota, this bougie suburb, we live so differently than people do in urban settings. And so I share this with you, but I struggle with how much of that is this very privileged position that I have, because I'm looking out my back window. My dogs are in the backyard, and we have a big, you know, backyard, and I have a garden, and we have landscaping and a fire pit. And then I can get in my truck and drive north to our family property and walk around in the woods for hours, you know. But a lot of the 8 billion people who share this planet with us don't have that. And I just wonder, like, for people like you and me who are committed to a theology of place, what do we do with that? That's what I'm struggling with right now.
Yeah. That's a good struggle. That's a real struggle.
And I'm not saying you have to solve my problems, but I'm just saying, no, you know.
I get it. Yeah. Well, I think, so here's a flip of that, a similar thing. So this, where that has risen up for me. So I love beautiful spaces. I love, like, so I always tell people, like, you know, I love Jesus and Martha Stewart. Those are like my first two loves, right? As a child, like, I stole my mother's Martha Stewart book at 10 o'clock. I mean, at 10 years old. And I love it. I love hospitality. I love dinner parties. I love decorating my house. I love hosting events. I love, we call it zhuzhing, right? Like, when we get ready for a group is coming in down at camp, we zhuzh everything, which means we put out throw blankets and we light candles and we make sure the fire
pits. Can you just spell that for me for the show notes? How do you spell that?
I can get it for you. It's bizarre. I have seen it. It's like, it involves a Z and a C and an A.
Right,
it's zhuzhing.
It
but I can text it to you. Yeah.
Okay, good.
I know, it's the it's the weirdest word. But I love all that stuff. And
yeah, yeah.
Right? Like, do I think that only people who have like coordinating pillows and throws and bespoke artwork have a beautiful home or are able to, do I only think camps and conference centers that have, you know, organic cotton sheets provide an opportunity for people to connect with God or themselves? No, that's bullshit, right? Like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, but do I also think that there is something to creating a beautiful environment to welcome people to? Yes, I do. I do think place matters, not just outdoor places. I mean, I think that's part of it, but I also think our indoor spaces matter. I think there's a reason we're all obsessed with Marie Kondo and Pinterest and Joanna Gaines and whatever, right? It, there's something about caring for our place and our space. And so I'm totally with you. It's how do you talk about it and elevating it without making it like a standard that people have to keep? Like, how do you talk about the heart of what you're actually talking about?
And frankly, even what you're doing, I mean, you're obviously hosting at your camp kids who come from urban environments in the summer. So they have those touch points of a more rural experience, being in the outdoors and stuff like that. And I mean, part of me is like, well, I don't want to be crass or something or heartless and say it's not my problem that people choose to live in urban environments. And some people, I think, don't have a choice. Like they don't know even how they would afford to live somewhere else. But it's just not the choice I'm making. And I think, I don't know how to, I don't know exactly what to do with it other than to say I want people to have more options to not. We don't have to relentlessly urbanize as a society, even though that seems to be the direction we're going, you know?
Amen. Yeah.
And I just wonder what role, like you tell me, you're more involved these days in church life than I am. I think like how can the church, is this something the church is ready to embrace, is a theology of place and to preach that and to give people tools for that?
If they're not, they need to be, because it's where we're headed. The thing is, you know, to get on the topic of your other podcast, right? Like it's all happening now. Like this the soup of traditions and different things are happening. I was telling somebody, I was talking to them about ministry of place, and I was talking to them about emergent stuff. And they were like, yeah, do you actually think it's happening? I said, when I wrote my first book, Baptists did not celebrate Advent. And now you cannot go into a Christian bookstore of any elk and not find a million Advent resources, right? So like I had to write the book because there wasn't anything for me to raise my kids as kind of a post-evangelical-ish, what emergent becoming Episcopalian, right? Like there was nothing for me, which is why I wrote that first book. And now they're everywhere. Like I even kind of just got out of that lane because there's people doing it so much better than me. And they're young and they have energy and right? Like they have little kids and they're doing it. They're doing it on Instagram and they have whole things. And what I think part of that is that we're going to lose our buildings. We just are. And in the Episcopal Church, at least, one of the fastest growing kind of new ministries that we are seeing is outdoor ministries. Wild church, beach church, hiking church, garden church. Good News Gardens, which is a Episcopal, basically kind of like Victory Gardens. It was started during COVID. I was one of the co-founders of it. And it was a way to kind of connect prayer and proclamation and planting all together, because people, wow, it was like during stay home orders. Right. And I was in charge of evangelism for the Episcopal Church at the time. And I was like, we can't go anywhere. How are we going to evangelize? And there was also like this creation care crisis. I mean, COVID's the direct result of abuse of creation. And so it was kind of this idea of like, well, what can we do to help people feel connected, to do something with their hands wherever they are? And so we came up with this thing called the Good News Gardens movement that asked people to plant more, proclaim more, and pray more. And we were like everything from a window box of rosemary, you know, that you can like put on bread, to whole crops. If you can plant more than you've ever planted before in order to share whatever, you know, what you're planting, if you can pray more for the healing of creation and our communities, and if you can proclaim the good news through these things by sharing and inviting and telling your story, et cetera, that would be great. And that thing went off like just boom. Like the response was outrageous. Within the Episcopal Church, and is still, you know, it's still the thing we see growing. And so I think there is this hunger. There's this hunger to connect in some way, even if it's just a potted plant, with creation, with place, and to say that our places matter. And it's almost, there's like this transient thing as we lose buildings. How can we still stay together? How can we still find ways to be community and worship? And, you don't have to pay any rent to go pray in the state park, right?
I totally agree with. And I think that's one of the answers to my quandary is to say there's public land of, and you know, it's one of the beauties of living in North America, as opposed to say Europe, where there's almost no public land. Wow. You know, the American conservation model is such that almost anywhere you live in the country, you can, in under an hour, you can be put your feet on public land that's owned by all of us, and you can walk there, and you can hunt there, and you can fish there, and you know, take, you know, whatever it may be. And so, yeah, I think that's right. But I also think it's so, I mean, this is what's going to be fascinating for me to watch. And I want to, you know, give you a couple of years and then have you back on to say, like, what are you in this new chapter now? What are you doing differently than when you landed in October 2023 in that place? Like, how have you made it your own? And then what practices are forming? What liturgical agrarian shenanigans are you up to, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, I can't wait to have that conversation. I can't wait to have it, because yeah, it's going to be interesting, because we landed here at a shifting moment, 100%. I think it's one of the reasons why we're here. I think it's one of the reasons they wanted us in particular here, because we kind of have a bigger imagination. And having the church-wide viewpoint that I have from my 5 years of working with our presiding bishop and seeing what is the thing that's unifying us across the board. And that's the thing. I mean, that's the thing that resonates in every part of the country I go to, that I travel to, and even the world, even, you know, the places I went to outside the U.S. Within the Episcopal Church. I mean, the place, that connection of the tradition with the place and how we do that. So the first event I did when we got here, because I just felt like we kind of needed to put a stake in the ground, right? When you first get to a new place, right? Like, and we did a foraging for Advent event here. And it was hugely successful in terms of, now you have to know Episcopal numbers, right? They're 50 people for us is like knocking it out of the park, right? And So, but yeah, we did this thing where we took an old tree that had fallen down. We sliced it into like circles that were, you know, I don't know, a couple of inches thick. Then we used a drill press, I think the guys used to drill holes for candles. So five holes, right, in the top of the log slice.
Mm-hmm.
And then we invited people to come and forage for whatever they wanted to make to decorate their wreaths with. And then we had beeswax, sheets of beeswax that you could roll up and make your candles. And they did. I mean, it was some of the pictures of those wreaths are some of the most beautiful Advent wreaths I've ever seen.
That's
and,
awesome.
Yeah. And so, and it wasn't just people from churches. It was like people from the community. It was people who had, most of the people who were here had never been here before. But it was like that connection of that tradition, right, with the outdoors. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. We all need an Advent wreath. So, because you can't have Advent without the candles and the wreath.
Right.
But, yeah. But here we are all outside. And it was, yeah, I mean, there were so many metaphors. Like, there were so many things you could, like, preach on forever because everything they were finding and using was, quote, unquote, dead or dried.
Yeah.
Right? So it's just interesting.
I love it.
Yeah.
Well, I am going to check back in with you after you've, you know, planted yourself there a little more. And I'd love to hear what you're up to. And I'm just going to make this final observation that you don't even need to respond to.
Okay. But
As someone, we're about the same age. We're both Gen Xers. We've both been, you know, sent our last kids off out into the world now. And I have a lot of friends, frankly, who are really struggling with that transition. I have multiple friends who are like in the midst of divorces or have just gotten divorced. They, you know, their kids leave and they look at each other and they're like, yeah, we don't really have anything in common other than our kids or whatever. And the fact that you guys took on this totally new challenge, you know, at this stage of your life, I think is fantastic. And I think it's the way those of us who are hitting middle age, us Gen Xers, are going to stay vibrant by tackling new challenges. So it's not even a question. I'm just like saying kudos to you. Courtney and I are trying to do the same thing to live vibrant lives now that we've said goodbye to our kids. So
yeah,
way to go. Yeah. It's just me saying pat on the back. Way to go.
Thank you. Yeah. We're not dead yet. Let's do some stuff, right?
Hell no.
I'm an Enneagram seven, wing eight. So I want to have fun and get shit done. So that's,
yeah. Have fun and get shit done. I love
let's
it.
Do
and
it. So, y'all come to camp sometime. You know.
You and I are going to cook up something fun together, and I'll tell listeners about that. So thanks a million for coming on. Uh-oh. And I'm so glad we're staying in touch and we're going to conspire and make some stuff happen.
Sounds good. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks so much.